Once you know how to recognize diet culture, you'll see that it's everywhere. Weight loss is a $70 billion industry built on the myth that a smaller number on the scale will secure your happiness, and that your ideal weight is waiting for you right on the other side of fewer carbs, intermittent eating windows, an intense workout, or a few more sips of flat tummy tea. Looking back, I can see how early the messaging seeped into my own brain. The rows of SlimFast cans lining the pantries of my friends' houses. The cover of my YM magazine sharing so-called secrets of girls who don't have to diet. The real secret is an open one. Diets don't work. Research has shown us for decades that the overwhelming majority of attempts to lose weight fail. And many folks who diet gain back more weight than they lost. All this while more Americans are on diets today than they were 10 years ago. So how can we stop barreling toward a future in which we're spending our hard-earned cash on things that lead us to less health, not more? This is Deconstructing Diet Culture, a special from Embodied. I'm Anita Rao.
So diet culture is this overarching system of beliefs and values that's really endemic to Western culture at this point in history.
Christy Harrison is an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health. She's also author of the book Anti-Diet: Reclaim Your Time, Money, Well-being, and Happiness Through Intuitive Eating. Before we get too deep into this conversation, I want to acknowledge something. We have all heard, maybe even from our own medical provider, that it is important to manage your weight and regulate your food intake, and that weight is an important marker of health. This show is not a substitute for medical or health advice, but the research that we're going to be talking about challenges a lot of that data and some of the big assumptions we all hold about health and our bodies. It may bring up some big questions for you. And if that's the case, please send those our way. We'll tell you how to get in touch with Embodied later in the show. Okay, back to Christy Harrison, the dietitian.
The system of beliefs worships thinness and equates it to health and moral virtue, promotes weight loss as a means of attaining higher status, both moral status and health status, demonizes certain foods and food groups and ways of eating while elevating others, and oppresses people who don't match up with its supposed picture of health and well-being. But it manifests in so many different ways, from overt diets that tell you to lose weight and those cover lines that say drop X number of pounds, to like the old school Weight Watchers and, you know, sort of having weight watching in the name, to the more sneaky manifestations like the new school Weight Watchers, where it's WW and it's all about wellness and, you know, diets calling themselves plans, programs, protocols, lifestyle changes, resets, reboots, and saying, oh, it's not a diet. This is not a diet. This is a lifestyle change. This is a way of being. So all of that really falls under the umbrella of diet culture because it all upholds that same system of beliefs and values that's been around for the last 150 years.
Well, how did we get to this point? Because one of the things that your book does is it really starts and kind of lays out this deep, long history back to ancient Greece and shows us that it was not always considered an undesirable thing to be fat. So take us back to that and help us understand that history.
Yeah, so really for most human civilizations around the world, for most of history, being fat was actually desirable, right? Fatness was seen as a sign of wellness, of having enough food, of wealth and well-being and, you know, sign of fertility. And thinness was seen as a sign of poverty, illness, death, infertility, weakness. You see that in a lot of the language that's been used around the words fat and thin in cultures throughout history. And sort of the first earliest recorded evidence that I could find of fat being demonized as a bad thing or being sort of considered anything less than desirable was in ancient Greece and Rome. There were really conflicting ideas there, though, about what fatness, quote unquote, meant, because on the one hand, you had still the language of, you know, fat being associated with wealth, fertility, well-being, and thinness being associated with sort of the opposite of those things. And aesthetically, the sort of medium fat aesthetic was sort of desirable, seen as desirable, you know, plumpness and curviness was seen as a good thing. But on the other hand, you had ancient Greek and Roman physicians starting to say that fatness was a bad thing. And this wasn't because of, you know, scientific evidence at the time. This was because of a belief system that ancient Greeks had about balance and moderation in all things being seen as a virtue. And so fatness was seen as an imbalance to be, quote unquote, corrected, the same way that thinness was seen as an imbalance, and that, you know, people needed to be aiming for this supposed perfect middle ground. And so fatness started to be demonized. And this is where we get the word diet, by the way. The word diet comes from the ancient Greek dieta, which means basically translates as regimen, a regimen of food and movement practices. And in the ancient Greek times, it was also, you know, bathing and sexual practices were thrown in there as well. But this idea of, you know, eating in a certain way and exercising in a certain way in order to achieve a certain ideal of health. And when you read these early writings, it's pretty wild to look at the sort of assumptions and meanings they're layering on to different diets. It's, you know, people who are morally correct and doing the right thing are eating in the way that's prescribed by ancient Greek physicians. People who are not doing those things are, quote unquote, barbarians.
That's so interesting, this question of virtue and morality, because even in preparation for this show, it was really clear to me in conversations with people that when we're talking about health, we're really talking about so many more things. People feel like the way that their weight is or the way that their health beliefs are really integrated into kind of their core value system, their core system of morality about the world. So it seems like that was cemented as kind of marks of social status or marks of social philosophy really early on.
Yeah, it started to be then, although interestingly, as, you know, after the fall of Rome, those ideas started to fade away and fatness became a virtue again, or a positive thing, or at least a morally neutral thing in a lot of most civilizations around the world, I would say. So the anti-fat belief system was sort of planted back then, but then it kind of went underground for a long time and really saw it emerge again in the 1800s in the U.S., when racist ideas about which ethnicities and which, you know, genders, also misogynistic ideas about the value of different bodies and of different people, was really in the foreground. And that started to lead to a demonization of fatness, because early evolutionary biologists who were working around that time started to point to fatness as a mark of, quote unquote, evolutionary inferiority, because people who had more fat on their bodies were supposedly women and people of color and groups that were being demonized at the time. And, you know, there's political reasons for that too, right? Justifying slavery, justifying misogyny and the oppression of women. So it really comes out of this oppressive belief systems, these systems of oppression, the idea that fatness was bad. And so it became, you know, the ancient Greek ideas about sort of the moral correctness of thinner bodies kind of came rushing back at that time.
Well, how about this question of health? Because even if people say, you know, sure, I can say that it's, you know, I'm morally neutral on whether fat is good or bad, which there's a lot to unpack there. But at what point did we begin to link weight and health?
Yeah, it's so interesting that emergence, because really what we see in the history is that moralistic ideas about body size predated any health arguments. Huh. So it wasn't that, you know, doctors were doing scientific research or clinical research and finding, oh, fatness seems to be associated with poor health and therefore it's undesirable. Actually, the cultural stigma against fat bodies was emerging first. And doctors actually at the time, you know, in the mid to late 1800s, thought that fatness was protective, that having more fat on the body was a good thing, that, you know, it was normal for people to gain weight as they aged, and sort of dismissing the idea of weight loss as unnecessary and sort of a distraction from the real health issues they needed to be addressing. Meanwhile, the cultural stigma against fatness was increasing. The fashion world was sort of turning towards a thinner ideal in the mid to late 1800s, really sort of the later half of the 1800s. So people increasingly were coming to doctors asking for weight loss tips and advice, and doctors were sort of scoffing and saying, you know, this is really unnecessary. This is, weight gain is a normal part of aging. You really don't need to be doing this. But the emergence of that anti-fat belief system pushed so many people to ask doctors for weight loss advice that eventually they sort of caved. The other piece of this was the insurance industry, the burgeoning...
Yeah, tell me about that. That's fascinating.
So fascinating. Yeah, so the burgeoning life insurance and then health insurance industries really started looking at, you know, they have their actuarial tables determining who's going to live longer, right? The life insurance industry, of course, is geared towards making money and making sure that they're having people in their insurance pool who are going to live the longest. And so they're doing this research to determine, like, who's a bigger risk. And they found from their early research in, you know, wealthy, white, middle-aged men that it seemed to be the larger-bodied men were dying sooner. And so they started to relay this information to doctors. They started to kind of coalesce behind a campaign of, you know, telling people not to be fat and having people lose weight as a way of supposedly reducing health risks. But really, it was about reducing monetary risks for the insurance industry. And so that growing pressure from the insurance industry on doctors, plus the growing public pressure that was coming from people who wanted to adhere to fashion standards and the thin ideal, started to push medicine in a really anti-fat direction, so that by the early 1900s, doctors were starting to offer weight loss advice and scales were becoming commonplace. And, you know, that's really when you see the emergence of these medicalized ideas about weight.
Christy Harrison is an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health. She's also the author of the book Anti-Diet. We'll continue our conversation about medical models and the role weight plays just ahead. You're listening to Deconstructing Diet Culture, a special from Embodied and North Carolina Public Radio. It's the panic we feel when our pants get too tight, when that loud internal voice reminds us we should have not eaten so much dessert last night. It's when you can no longer scroll by the Instagram fitness influencers who sell meal plans and 10-day programs for resetting our bodies. Welcome to Diet Culture, where thinness, products, and false science are everything, and true health and well-being are not the priority.
There's this idea in society and medicine that all of us should be completely responsible for our health and that we can prevent all disease or treat all of our conditions through diet and exercise, and it's just not the case.
I'd love people to know that, guess what? I know I'm fat. You don't need to tell me. You don't need to tell me with your body language. You don't need to tell me explicitly or implicitly. I already know that.
I would say most of the time, weight is not a cause, quote unquote. It's, you know, a sort of a red herring.
This is Deconstructing Diet Culture, a special from Embodied in North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Anita Rao. I've been talking with Christy Harrison. She's an anti-diet registered dietitian with a master's in public health and the author of the book Anti-Diet. I want to introduce you now to Dr. Louise Metz. She's an internal medicine physician and owner of Mosaic Comprehensive Care in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Dr. Metz, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Dr. Metz, at the forefront of many people's minds when we are talking about this conversation and as we're hearing Christy kind of outline this history is this big red flag of like obesity, the obesity epidemic. But we can't do things the way that we used to back in the 1800s because our food system looks so different and we have this mass public health epidemic today.
So I think it's helpful to really look at the research on weight and health. And before I do so, it's important to note that I don't use the terms obesity or overweight unless I'm referring to the research. But in general, when I'm doing my clinical work, I use the terms higher weight or larger body. But when referring to some of the research, you'll hear those words. But I think it's helpful to look back at even the history of the BMI. So the body mass
Tell
index.
Tell me about the history of the BMI.
It's very interesting. So it was actually originally created by a Belgian astronomer in the 1830s. And he created this measure to really look at just the average size of men. And it was designed for populations, not for individuals, and was not designed to define health in any way. And then moving on later to the modern age, it was used to begin defining health somewhere in the 1900s. And then later on in the late 90s, what we found is that these arbitrary categories for BMI were suddenly changed. So the definitions of obesity and overweight were suddenly decreased, and 29 million people suddenly became, quote, overweight or obese overnight. And these changes really were not based in any research that showed that there was a direct link between these BMI categories and health.
So, Christy, you really unpacked that history and what was going on internally in the NIH at the point that these numbers and these categories got reset. And can you illuminate to some of our listeners about the origin story of this idea of an obesity epidemic and what you think may be missing in the way the conversation as we usually have it?
Yeah, it's so fascinating, the origins of this, because people don't know that it came out of just a couple of researchers looking at data on how average weights in the American population seem to have increased over time a little bit. You know, it was an average of a single-digit number of pounds between, you know, the 70s and the 90s. It was very low amount. But they were looking at this data, and by the way, the average height of Americans had also increased during that time. But you had one researcher who's sort of leading the charge on this idea that this was a problem, that Americans' weights were increasing. His name was William Dietz. Is William Dietz. It's spelled like diets with a Z, which you really can't make this stuff up. But he, you know, was looking at this research. And, you know, he, and as I trace in my book, he and many, many other researchers who are in the field of so-called obesity research are financed and funded by pharmaceutical industry, the pharmaceutical industry, by the diet industry. Many of them have their own diet plans and programs that they are selling and, you know, have this financing that's coming from basically people with a vested interest in making Americans fear weight gain and think that their body size is a problem.
But there are, I just want to pause you for a second there, because the CDC does link obesity to a range of health consequences: high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, coronary artery disease, osteoarthritis. So people may say that it is important to talk about weight in this context because it is correlated with a number of diseases. Maybe Dr. Metz, you can take that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good question. So we do know that there are certain health conditions that are correlated with body size. But we talk a lot about how this is a correlation and not necessarily causation. So we don't have proof that it's the body size causing these health conditions.
What else could it be?
So there are several other mediators of that. So one could be cardiovascular fitness. So we have some data to show that that could be a mediator between body size and health. So there's one study that looked at this and found that in people who have low cardiovascular fitness levels, mortality rates were higher with higher BMIs. But in the individuals who had higher cardiovascular fitness, we found that the mortality rates evened out across body size. And that, in fact, people who were, quote, overweight or obese and were active cardiovascularly had lower mortality rates than those with a normal BMI who were inactive. So that's
one
of the
How about type 2 diabetes, which I think is one of the most common ones that comes up in this, because there has been research showing that losing some weight may lessen your risk of developing type 2 diabetes. So people may say, well, why not err on the side of caution? Why is mm-hmm. it so bad to talk about weight management mm-hmm. when we're trying to reduce things like type 2 diabetes?
Yeah, I think we're sort of asking the wrong questions mm-hmm. and that there are assumptions behind those questions, and that it is likely not the body size that is causing diabetes, again, but there may be other mediators like genetics. So someone might be predisposed to have a higher body weight and have diabetes. And someone might be exposed to chronic dieting and weight cycling, which we might get into more, that as well as weight stigma are increasing risk of conditions like diabetes. And so that's another mediator, that it's not their body size, but it's these other factors that are contributing to conditions like diabetes.
Well, I'd love to get to that, because I know, mm-hmm. Christy, you say that, yes, you agree that there is a correlation between higher weight and some of these conditions, but we can't draw any conclusions until we control for both weight stigma and weight cycling. So if you could kind of briefly explain both of those and how you think they cloud our picture of what we think we know about the link between weight and health.
Yeah, so weight stigma is discrimination against people in larger bodies, and sort of all the outcomes of that discrimination in healthcare and across the sort of culture. Like, you know, people are told to lose weight and shamed at the doctor's office. They're teased on the playground. They're, you know, paid lower wages in the job market. And weight cycling is this repeated cycle of weight loss and regain that people undergo when they try to intentionally lose weight. And we see in the research that up to 98% of the time when people embark on weight loss efforts, they end up regaining all of the weight they lost within 5 years, if not more. In fact, up to two-thirds of people who embark on weight loss efforts may regain more weight than they lost. And so, you know, weight stigma and weight cycling are both things that are disproportionately experienced by people in larger bodies, right? People in larger bodies have weight stigma lobbed at them from every which way from the time they're children, usually.
Well, that's, I mean, you said two-thirds of people will gain the weight back and more. That's a pretty shocking statistic. Can you explain why? What are the factors that contribute to that regaining of the weight?
Yeah, so it's really, you know, interesting and complex, and I think it basically boils down to the fact that our bodies are wired for survival. Mm. Our bodies are wired to resist starvation, and they have all kinds of biological mechanisms that kick in a situation of lack of food, right, because the body perceives that as famine. And so it will do things like turn down your fullness hormones so that you keep eating longer in the presence of food, ramp up your hunger hormones so that you're more likely to seek out food, turn down your body temperature so that you're not burning as much energy. Reduce your reproductive function because that requires energy and that's seen as sort of a nice to have but not essential function in a situation of famine. And, you know, ramps down digestion. There's just a million things, little things that your body does to help you survive in a situation of lack of food.
Christy, how about kids and children and so-called childhood obesity and this question of whether we should be getting our kids moving more and eating less processed food to prevent poor health outcomes down the line. What is your approach to this as a registered dietitian, as a public health expert? How do you look at questions like that?
Yeah, my approach is really the same as I would take in an adult population, which is to acknowledge that, you know, diets don't work, that weight cycling is the most likely outcome of efforts at weight loss, that weight stigma and weight cycling are both independent risk factors for health problems and likely explain most, if not all, of the excess risk that we see in people in larger bodies. So I really don't recommend that parents put their kids on diets or that kids themselves try to put themselves on diets. I acknowledge that, you know, weight stigma is so prevalent in our culture that, of course, parents want to save kids from that fate and kids themselves probably want to escape that fate. But, you know, to me, the solution is not to diet because that's just going to be futile, you know, and actually likely harmful in the long run. But to, you know, work on self-acceptance, health at every size approaches to well-being that don't have anything to do with weight.
Diet culture shapes how we think about food, but also fitness. What a fit body looks like and how folks not in thin bodies are treated in fitness spaces is something Myrna Valerio has thought a lot about. She's known affectionately as the Myrnavator. She's an ultra runner and author of the book A Beautiful Work in Progress, which traces her experience as an athlete in a larger body. Myrna, welcome to Embodied.
Thank you for having me.
The Myrnavator. I mean, you can't really get much better than that nickname. So we've been talking a lot in this show about weight and health and bodies and navigating diet culture. And I'd love to just start there with you. Could you talk a bit about kind of the ways that diet culture shows up in your own day-to-day life as someone in a larger body?
Sure. I can talk about, you know, my son is with me for the year, and part of what he has to do each day is to go out and get some exercise. So he goes out and play basketball, he runs, and does whatever he does outside as a 16-year-old. And we had a lot of carbs the other day, and he came back home and said, "Mom, I need to stop eating so many carbs." Mm. And I said, "Well, why?" He said, "Well, because it's carbs, and carbs are bad for you." And I said, "But you just did 3 hours of exercise. You have burned a lot of calories, and so you need to refuel yourself. That's why we get hungry for carbs." And so I know, even in my own home where I do really focus on intuitive eating and exercise and just being outside and feeling really, really good and mentally and emotionally healthy. You know, even that seeps into my own home from media, from social media,
yeah.
from the athletic world. And so, yes, it's, you know, even though we live in a home such as we do, it is still very, very pervasive.
Well, yeah, I think something that, you know, people in any body size can relate to, given that we live in diet culture, is this kind of ongoing messaging that the size of your body and the shape of your body matters. People are looking at it. People judge you by it. And I know you've experienced that firsthand. I mean, you've done documentaries where you describe some of the really hateful comments and language people use about you being a larger bodied runner, outrunning trails. How do you approach this kind of weight stigma at this point in your life?
Well, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about my experience first with medical professionals. And I actually pulled up a piece that I had written in my blog a couple of years ago, my blog, Fat Girl Running. And it says, it's not very eloquent, but it says, "So I was at the doctor's today filling out a bunch of paperwork. Under the question, anything else you would like us to know, this is what I wrote. I was in a mood. Please do not ask me to exercise or to lose weight. I'm a very, very active person. I run marathons and I work out 4 to 6 days a week. I know I'm overweight and I've been working at slow and permanent weight loss for the past 5 years. Please actually read my chart before you start talking about these things. I would highly appreciate it." And so, because I had had so many instances where I'd walk into a doctor's office, a pulmonologist or a gynecologist, and they would immediately, even though I had told them that I was, you know, training for a marathon and I wanted to make sure that I didn't drop dead during the marathon. So could they check me out and make sure I was okay? Do you exercise? I just told you I run marathons. And so, you know, that judgment, you know, we're humans, we judge people, we categorize people because it makes it easier for us to navigate socially in our society. But we do have the intellectual capacity to go beyond that. And that's what I find that I come up against in the medical profession with, you know, people out on the trail. You know, should you really be doing this? Mm. Shouldn't you just go on a diet? The questions are always, always there on people's faces. The questions about whether I really do the things that I say that I do because I'm still fat, despite the fact that I've done 14 ultra marathons and 10 marathons, despite that I train almost every day, despite the fact that I do sky running and mountain running. People always have these questions. And in fact, I was at the TCS New York City Marathon Expo, and a race director came up to me, not of that particular marathon, and asked me, you know, "Well, don't you think there's something wrong or something going on with your body that causes you not to lose weight?" Mm. In front of my family, actually. And it was a very distressing moment.
I want to put that to Dr. Metz, mm-hmm. just to kind of answer this question about size diversity and body diversity. So when someone like Myrna is active, is, you know, practicing intuitive eating, and their weight lands in the way that it does, but it is still at a higher weight, is that common and is that okay?
Yeah, good question. So, yeah, so I think taking it back to that idea of size diversity, which is one of the main tenets of the Health at Every Size approach, is that, again, we all come in different shapes and sizes, and our behaviors are independent of that. So we can't look at someone and know what behaviors they're engaging in or what their health status is based on their body size. And we need to really begin to kind of separate those things. And unfortunately, as she describes it, this is so common in healthcare. So one study showed that I think 68% of people in larger bodies experience significant weight bias or stigma in the doctor's office. Mm. And, you know, doctors really need to address that bias that we have because we're really harming people by providing that weight stigma.
And it can also lead to misdiagnoses. Is that right?
Definitely, definitely. I think that those baseline assumptions based on someone's body size are going to lead to inaccurate diagnoses. So there's typically an assumption that if someone lives in a larger body that they must have elevated blood pressure or diabetes. And if we assume that based on body size, we will clearly misdiagnose a large percentage of people. And the same goes for someone in a smaller body. If we assume they are healthy based on that body, we will misdiagnose a high number of people who have metabolic conditions.
Myrna, what do you wish that people better understood about life in a fat body in today's society rampant with diet culture?
Well, I can really only speak to my own experience, but I'd love people to know that, guess what? I know I'm fat. You don't need to tell me. You don't need to tell me with your body language. You don't need to tell me explicitly or implicitly. I already know that. So it doesn't help me to keep pointing that out, whether I'm out on the trail, whether I'm out on the road, whether I'm just trying to sit and be me and exist in this world as I am.
Okay, we are almost out of time, but Dr. Metz, I just want to end with you. If you have any kind of takeaway tips for listeners who have heard this and maybe want to think about approaching their health differently or think about approaching going to the doctor differently, do you have any kind of brief takeaway points you want people to know about this different approach?
Yes, I think the things that I would say is that if you're going to your doctor, one thing is that you do not have to be weighed. It is your right to decline to be weighed. And so that you certainly can decline when you go. The other thing is to let your provider know that you would like medical care from a health at every size perspective, and that you would not want to discuss weight or weight management at your visit, that you have the right to ask for that. And another helpful quote that we learned from Reagan Chastain, she will say that if the doctor is recommending something, recommending weight loss for a condition that you have and you don't think it's appropriate, you can ask, well, what would you recommend for someone in a smaller body? What testing or treatment would you recommend for someone who's thin?
My thanks to ultra runner Myrna Valerio, dietitian Christy Harrison, and Dr. Louise Metz. You can learn more about all of them, their research, and their work at our website, embodiedwunc.org. And as promised, here's how you can get in touch with the show. Email embodied@wunc.org. We're also on Instagram and Twitter at embodiedwunc. Coming up, how to make fitness culture more inclusive. We'll be right back. Moving my body as a kid happened with zero forethought. I unknowingly burned calories while chasing my siblings around the backyard, riding my bike through the neighborhood, and hitting music video moves when my favorite song came on the radio. At some point, movement became less intuitive and more formal.
I was, and still am in a lot of ways, triggered by hearing the word fitness, because even before you kind of get engrossed in fitness culture, you are inundated into diet culture and some of the toxic messages.
Those messages are perpetuated both inside gyms and in society at large.
The gym is basically a hallmark of ableism. It's the most concentrated place for ableism because it literally indicates who is able to work on their body and who is not.
So what would it take to tune back into our own bodies and build fitness spaces that are accessible to people regardless of their race, gender, or ability? This is Deconstructing Diet Culture, a special from Embodied and North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Anita Rao. There is a growing movement to make fitness culture a more inclusive one. Ilya Parker is a leading voice in that effort. In fact, that was Ilya's voice you heard talking about how fitness is a trigger word. Ilya is a physical therapist assistant, a certified medical exercise specialist, and the owner of Decolonizing Fitness. Ilya, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anita, for having me.
Thank you for being here. Also with us is Natalie Petrozella. She's an associate professor of history at the New School and author of the forthcoming book, Fit Nation, How America Embraced Exercise as the Government Abandoned It. Natalia, hey, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Of course. So I'd love to start with you, Ilya. Tell me a bit about how you thought about movement and exercise growing up. What did that look like for you?
So it really wasn't much thought about movement and exercise, honestly. My first entrance into fitness was literally through my medical transition. And firstly, I want to name that gender-affirming care is necessary care for folks. And so I experienced a lot of medical gatekeeping from my primary care physicians who were literally refusing to either initiate gender-affirming care or would refuse to refer me to an endocrinologist, which is who I needed to see to receive hormone replacement therapy.
I mean, so what you bring up so early on is this very direct connection between how we think about our bodies in a very medical sense and how we think about wellness and fitness and what movement looks like. And so as you were going through this medical transition and working to advocate for yourself with doctors, how did that affect what you were doing in terms of movement and how you were thinking about movement in your own life?
Yeah, so when I finally was able to find a doctor who was willing to work with me, initially I was met with medicalized fat phobia. The doctor, who was also in a larger body, a body that was much more larger than mine, which was interesting, was wanting to prescribe me diet pills, essentially, in particular appetite suppressant pills, which I adamantly refused. And they were like, hey, if you're unwilling to take this prescription, then I'm going to need for you to lose X amount of pounds before we can initiate that. So again, coupled with my already fear of fitness as a whole, and now I'm essentially being coerced to engage in fitness because I didn't want to take the appetite suppressants. And I wanted to engage in hormone replacement therapy. So I felt like I had no choice but to immediately be forced into fitness. So I was very, very upset by that. And then when I entered the fitness industry, I was bombarded with messages via diet culture about what, in particular, quote unquote, a female body should look like, and mixed with messages of why I shouldn't want to transition and modify my body in ways that affirm my gender. So I had a very, very complicated relationship with fitness early on, which essentially shaped the work that I'm doing now.
And Natalia, I mean, I would love for you to help us understand how we got here. How do we get to this point where we think about fitness in this particular way? You have studied the history. What were the trends?
Yeah, so, you know, the big story in how we became a nation in which we're even having these conversations where fitness culture and the pressure to be fit is kind of so ubiquitous. I mean, that in itself is really a strange story because before 1950, there really wasn't a cultural pressure to go to the gym, to be fit. If anything, if you were someone who wasn't an athlete and you wanted to go to the gym and exercise regularly, it was a little subversive. Like, it was a little strange. Mm. If you were a man, the idea that you would care so much about your body and your appearance as opposed to more serious things, or that you'd want to spend time in the company of like other sweaty men, that immediately made you suspicious. And like male gyms were seen as places for people who were, you know, quote unquote, sexually deviant. So there's that, which is very different from how we consider like men who work out today in many ways. And then for women, the sense was, well, you know, you're going to be muscular. That's very masculine. These are unfeminine virtues of like strength and individualism and competitiveness that get cultivated in exercise environments, you know, plus your uterus might fall out and then you can't have babies. And what use would you be then? And so actually before 1950, even though you had a kind of nascent fitness culture with industrialization because people were more sedentary, it really was not normalized. After 1950, both with the rise of a kind of service economy where more and more people were sedentary, and with suburbanization for kind of white middle-class folks for whom leisure was considered aspirational but also took effect on your body, you start to have the idea of like, oh, you need to exercise regularly taking shape. And then the last point I'll make there about the 50s is a turning point, the Presidential Council on Youth Fitness and that big PE push in the 1950s. That was huge because it really kind of sanitized the idea of regular exercise and made it virtuous. Like, if you're a good citizen, you exercise. And they spoke of this in like unapologetically fat, shamey ways. I mean, JFK gives this big talk about the soft American and how an American who is physically soft is a national liability. And so that's kind of this really interesting turning point that I think gets us to some of the experiences that I heard Ilya talking about just now before.
As you both have echoed, our understandings of gender and which gendered body types we aspire toward and which spaces are open to folks of various genders comes through constantly. And we heard from a listener about this who's actually a fitness instructor themselves. And I want to listen to that clip now.
Throughout my teaching experience, you know, I started with an understanding of myself as a cisgender heterosexual person, but then later on came out as a trans bisexual person. And this has really changed how I interact with fitness spaces and really see the scripts that people use in just moving their bodies or even instructing others to move their bodies that create these gendered ideas. It's this like really classic thing of like, oh, men should be large and muscular and stronger, whereas women should be better at these like aerobic kinds of exercises. But all of these are so limiting to what the body can be. And in my instruction, in the way I've changed my thinking of just both myself and my students, is that the body can be anything and it can have any relationship to gender.
That was Bree Sikorsky in Durham, a fitness instructor who is studying inclusive fitness for their master's thesis. And I'm curious, Ilya, your response to that and how you've seen these particular gender norms show up in fitness spaces and in informing what people think fitness can mean for them based on how their body presents.
Yes, I love Bree. Bree summed it up perfectly. And it is a way, I think the hugest piece of inclusivity is thinking about the language. And it's countless group classes that I've been in where language was so important, especially when you're like, hey, guys can only do this exercise, ladies can only do this exercise, and then also making the assumption that you know who's in the room by gendering the entire room, by saying, hey, ladies, let's have a great session. And so I think it's important to really, first, I really want to say trainers who need to recognize that our curriculums in fitness have limited us in a lot of ways. And there's a whole bunch of education that needs to happen outside of your certificate. So I don't expect people to immediately know how to work with a diverse group of bodies, especially when you roll in the gender piece, because gendered is slathered in everything, every way we move. So it's important to do a lot of learning and unlearning when you enter into fitness culture. And it is as simple as making sure you're mindful of what you don't know, asking questions and doing the research so you can show up a better way.
And I mean, when we think about power and who wields power in these spaces, a group of people that come to mind to me are the fitness instructors themselves. And I know, Natalia, you've thought about this, and it's something I've thought about so often when taking a group fitness class, is being really kind of captivated and entranced in this world that the particular instructor creates. And the language that they use in that class can really get into your head in such a specific way. I'd love for you to talk more about that and kind of how we can prevent these potential abuses of power that people in fitness spaces can exert.
Yeah, so I've definitely written about this as kind of a scholar, right? Thinking about how the fitness instructor as a figure has come to gain kind of more and more cultural power, right? Oh, they're my guru, they're my therapist, they're my DJ, they're a sex symbol. But actually, we don't really have a robust conversation or a set of like professional norms that govern the nature of that role. So when, you know, some people are going and seeing a fitness instructor more than they're seeing their therapist or like more regularly than they're seeing some people in their family. And that's a lot of power to wield. And I think that it's not just, oh, we need to like make fitness culture more equitable and accessible or like have more people have access to what's largely a privatized space. But like what's going on in that space? space? Do we actually want more people to be involved and enmeshed in a world that's perpetuating some really damaging things? Probably not. So why don't we think about, you know, what the best of it is and try to amplify that and build out those kind of pedagogies and take them seriously as pedagogies, not just like, oh, this is this little leisure thing that you do. Oh, it's just fitness, you know, some ditzy instructor, but rather think these are sites where really, you know, powerful relationships are forged and that we all have a responsibility to think about how that power operates.
Yeah. And I mean, I know, Ilya, you've written a bit about, you know, being a fitness instructor who doesn't look like what people think fitness instructors should look like. And so while certain fitness instructors may wield a lot of power, there's also this barrier to entry for folks who don't fit the traditional norm of a fitness instructor. So how do you think about power in the context of your role as someone who guides people in movement and shapes how they think about movement?
Yeah, when I really began to disconnect from this myth, this standard that's set in fitness where you have to be this walking aesthetic billboard of your services and your knowledge and your value. And when I really started peeling back from that and saying, hey, I'm knowledgeable in my lived experience in my body, and I'm okay to share those things with other people. And if they believe and if they want to learn with me, we can take this journey together, and we can also create a co-learning environment. Because I think, too, when it comes to personal training in particular, number one, you don't have to get certified to call yourself a personal trainer. And you're immediately deemed an expert, especially if you have muscles bulging through your skin. And we create this culture where we're fearful to say, hey, I actually don't know a lot. I'm literally practicing beyond my scope in a lot of ways, and I'm messing people's lives up. And so when we're able to have these authentic conversations and allow ourselves to be vulnerable as trainers, because I'm very vulnerable with my clients. When I say, hey, I don't know this thing. I've never worked with a person who moves in the way that you do. I want to learn, but guess what? I have resources, so I can actually patch you in with someone else that may be more appropriate for you. And it's okay. And again, I know it's a capitalist notion, and we want to try to maintain as many clients as we can, and we don't want to lose folks, but we have to understand that we are doing damage when we're literally trying to work with people and we have no clue. Mm-hmm. And we're also doing damage when we say, hey, I know a whole bunch, but just because you have a body and I don't like the way it looks and the way it moves and the way it shows up, I'm going to act like you don't exist, and I'm only going to train people that look just like me. So that's what I'm really trying to work through. We're creating a culture of vulnerability and openness and willingness to grow and learn together.
Thanks to Ilya Parker and Natalia Petrozella for joining me in this conversation. And thank you for listening to Deconstructing Diet Culture, a special from Embodied and North Carolina Public Radio. Conversations like this that help us better understand our brains and bodies drive the mission of Embodied, which is also available as a podcast on your favorite audio app. We have a great community of engaged listeners, and we'd love to have you too. Find us on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Spotify, and more. And there's a whole lot more Embodied at our website, including info on the guests you heard in this show, embodiedwunc.org. Embodied is produced by Josie Taras, Kaya Finlay, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Our editorial lead is Amanda Magnus. Anthony Howard is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Lindsay Foster Thomas is the director of content at North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anisha Rao, taking on the taboo with you.